Good afternoon, folks. Welcome back. It's my pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker today, Ted Peterson. Ted got his PhD in 1998 at SMU. He's now a full professor at the University of Minnesota at Duluth. You all know him from his work in WordNet and on WordCenter's evaluation. And you may also have seen that editorial he wrote in Computational Linguistics very recently, in which he talked about problems with distribution and replicability, distribution of software and replicability of results in NLP, and how our frequent failure to be able to do that affects the science that we're able to do. And Mark and I were very impressed by it, and I'd be making a wonderful keynote speaker for this meeting, as I'm sure you will. And so please welcome our speaker.
Can I take this out okay?
Yeah.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I've enjoyed this this workshop a great deal. There've been some really interesting presentations thus far, and mine will be a little bit of a departure from that because I'm not going to be delving into deep technical issues, but rather more reflecting a little bit more on some of the themes that came up on the computational linguistics piece that was mentioned, and trying to. Maybe try and tie our enterprise a little bit more closely to some of kind of traditional science and argue perhaps that if we think a little bit more about the science we're doing, our software engineering will perhaps get even better. And if we think a little bit more about the software engineering we're doing, that our science will improve too. So I think they're quite linked. And so the title of the talk is the Road from Good Software Engineering to Good Science is a Two-Way Street. And, you know, the notion is that you know, I think we, especially if, you know, we develop a lot of software and things like that, it's very easy to kind of get very focused on that. But I think it's also important to remember that many or most of us are a part of a larger enterprise, and that enterprise is science. I mean, even beyond computational linguistics. And so so I think that gives us a framework in which to view things. And so there's going to kind of be three general themes in this talk. This is to give you kind of fair warning of where we're heading here. A bit of philosophy, a little interlude on goodness and being good, and then some lessons from science, from the history of science, and hopefully tying this all together into something that's coherent. So a few words about philosophy, and of course, good science, good software engineering, what is good, and we could wax on this for quite a long time if we wished. We are talking here about not goodness as sort of moral qualities or things like that. We're not aspiring to higher kinds of goodness. We're simply hoping for a certain level of quality. Good as in high quality, not moral excellence. And so that's the kind of goodness we're talking about. Although we will drift over into moral excellence just a little bit later. So, yeah, it's amazing really what you can fit into these things. So the unifying theme, in case it gets lost as we go through this, is something like this. A fundamental premise is that our community, computational linguistics, natural language processing I'm thinking of here, should think a bit more about science and about being able to reproduce results and formulate theories that let us make predictions about language. I mean, in the end, I think that's a huge part of the mission here. And my personal feeling is that the key to making that happen is making our software and data more usable, more available, and that making acts of sharing that kind, those kinds of resources, make those more central to our field. And I will try and motivate this in various ways, but a very pragmatic kind of motivation is that if we can achieve that, achieve the ability to reproduce results, share things, however we do that, the odds are our software engineering is pretty good, because it's very hard to imagine, you know, sort of low quality or poorly conceived software engineering as leading to anything like that. So So that's some of the basic motivations. Now, so we move to science. We'll talk a little bit about science, and we'll actually talk quite a lot about science. And what do we mean by science, and what is science? And there are there's a whole philosophy of science that you could get a PhD in that, and study for the rest of your life. But one sort of simple definition of what we're doing when we're trying to do science is that we're hoping to develop theories or models that let us make some kinds of predictions about the world. I mean, just whatever we're doing. In our case, of course, we're typically talking about language. And so developing models that let us do things with language, predict things about language, and move forward. Now, good science, again, this is not in terms of moral excellence, but rather just high quality science. I think for science to be considered good, that a good scientist follows methods and records them in such a way that there are experimental findings that an independent observer, somebody outside of the laboratory, outside of the immediate cadre of disciples, is able to reproduce. That's good science. And there's also the good as in moral excellence and so forth, and working on problems that are important to the world and things like that. But here, just talking about methodology and quality. And so, so we're defining terms here. That's sort of what we're saying about good science. Good software engineering, again, we, are in effect having a workshop on that topic, and we could again do a PhD dissertation and write books about it. But I think that the definition that I am going to offer is that good software engineering are whatever those methods are that result in software that anyone can use anytime, anywhere. And we'll explain a little bit more about that, but that's the gist: anyone, anytime, anywhere, and that they can reproduce our results anytime, anywhere, anyone. We do that, however we do it. That's probably pretty good software engineering. So let's reflect on that just a little bit more, and again, kind of trying to maybe tie the science and the software together a little bit. So many of our papers are remarkably empirical, full of results, and we can think of those results in our papers or internally as, in a sense, the test cases for your ideas, much the same way as we think about software engineering sorts of test cases. And your software, then, is important, and you can't discount the role of your software in your science, because that's where these results are coming from, and that's, in effect, what is, in the end, going to validate your approach or not. And so it is unfortunate, though, to some degree, there's often a case or an argument made that, well, the software isn't really that important. It's other stuff that matters here. And the other stuff matters, but things you hear might be like, well, I'm not really so worried about the software. It's the ideas. That's really what counts. And of course ideas count, that's true. And then of course my personal favorite, the algorithm is described in the paper. So you make the request for some code, and the response is, wow, you should be able to reproduce this based on the algorithm in the paper. And it's just a prototype. There's all kinds of things that one can hear. People become candid after you press them a little bit, and it's like, well, got some new hardware in the lab, and I don't know, lost the last 5 years worth of work, it's gone and stuff. This is maybe the truest and most accurate explanation of why we don't see more software in our discipline, and that's just because a lot of the work is done by students, graduate students, postdocs, who have a fairly short time in our groups and move on. And when they move on, they take with them an incredible amount of knowledge that, unless we're very careful about, we lose. And so, it leads to all kinds of difficulties. So all of this is understandable. I mean, I have suffered from many or all of these conditions myself. But in the end, it's not really acceptable. It's not acceptable to sort of make arguments that discount the importance of our software when we exist in such a highly empirical time. I mean, the, you know, if you were at NACL this week, I mean, how many tables of results did you look at? I mean, you know, as you sit in a talk, if you're like me, you ask yourself the question, well, what would I have to do to actually get those results? You know, and it's the best case for the author. It's like, I love this idea, I want to use it. How long is it going to take me to do that? In most cases, I found my own personal answer was maybe a little while. There were a few exceptions to that, though, that were good to see where people actually had the code up and ready to go, which was great. Again, if we think of ourselves as scientists, which I think we should, I mean, we do a lot of engineering, we do a lot of linguistics and things like that, but I think in general, you know, I view this as kind of a scientific community in some ways. If you imagine like a physicist or someone, you know, sort of saying something like, well, I did this experiment, got some results, and I'd like you to accept them. And no, you can't look at the software. And you can't look at the data either. Just accept it. You know, it's good stuff. I'll just assume that you have maybe 6 months to 8 months to actually reinvent or re-implement my method. And that should be based on, you know, this incomplete description that I've offered you. And it's remarkable to me that we accept that. And I think to some degree that we do. And I sense it changing a bit, but I think that's still a little bit of an issue. Usually the message is saying you can re-implement it from the description in the paper, end with a nice cheery little cheers, you know, and go on your way. And you know, that's all good. It's actually not good, but it's a lot of things. But I don't think it's fair to call that science. And so if you accept the premise that we're engaged in scientific enterprise, I think you have to have a little higher standard, particularly in terms of your ability to reproduce results and verify results and really put these ideas through the ringer. And then not only just to discredit them, but more importantly, to use them. I mean, you know, what if somebody really did solve your major problem and you want to do that? I mean, that's how science moves forward. We build on what each other have done. This is the article that was mentioned, and some of these themes are in that, and so we're kind of hitting on some of those, but there are some additional ideas that we'd like to discuss a little bit more here. And one of them is really sort of how to think about software and NLP, and I think it's fair to say we're reaching a stage in the development of this community where, I mean, software is very central, and It's to me reaching a point where if you said, well, let's do computational linguistics without really a lot of software, without a lot of data, it's impossible to imagine that. And it's kind of like doing physics now without a super collider. I mean, there are physicists that don't have, this is a super collider apparently. And so it's sort of like, you know, saying to some segment of the physics community, you don't really need that, you know, and whatever, you know, it's not important. It's sort of like imagining astronomy these days without space telescope, Hubble Space Telescope, in that we're reaching an advanced, you know, sort of civilization where we have a lot of technology around us and a lot of our science depends on it. And I think our particular discipline should be, you know, is to some degree much the same. But we clearly don't have things like a super collider for NLP, where we can all sort of sign up, get time on the super collider, and solve and do great experiments that others can come along and reproduce. We don't seem to have that quite yet, but I think it's not an unreasonable model. So when we're thinking about good software, then going back to the definition, if we have good software, this should work for us anytime, anywhere, and for anyone. And again, there are lots and lots of other definitions, you know, it's an encapsulation and it's modular and all that good stuff. But I think in the end, if we're thinking about making tools that other people can use to further their own science, we want to have those kinds of definitions in place as well, and those kinds of attitudes in place. And so the anyone part is important. And I find as I discuss these issues, if you talk about the rest of the world, everyone is to some degree sympathetic. But if you suggest to people that they think in terms of their own self-interest, it becomes even more of a motive. And so anyone includes you in the future. And I think if we reflect upon that, we can oftentimes see that maybe the engineering and what we're doing isn't perhaps quite up to that level of for anyone. Because I consider you in the future to be anyone. You know, your future instances are just as important to me as the graduate student in, you know, China or whatever. So I want you to be able to use your software 6 months from now, and indeed 5 years from now. I assume that, you know, while science moves along quickly, there are things that we come back to or that we continue to work on, and your own code should work for you in 5 years. And it should also be doing this for other people. And so the nice benefit of that is if you think in terms of your own self-interest, other people will derive that same benefit. And the important thing is that I think we want to have the attitude, and I think many people do. I mean, I'm not suggesting that this is unique insight or anything, but I think it is important to think or believe that what you're working on is important, and that even if you have moved on to other problems, aren't responding to email or doing something completely different, what you did and what you worked on, either as a graduate student or a researcher or faculty, whatever, that is still important even if you happen to be doing something else. And again, this can be something that maybe somebody else picks up and carries forward and advances the general cause of science as a result. And so, again, if your software can do that, probably pretty well engineered. And so I think that can be a standard by which we can go back and retrospectively look at some of our older code. Go back and find some code you wrote a couple of years ago and see if you can make any sense of it, see if you can run it. If so, you're doing a good job. I mean, and that's a great feeling when that happens. I think it's reasonable to start asking questions over the longer scale. 40 years, I mean, it sounds sort of like a long time to me, maybe not as long as it once was, but also I find, too, that 40 years ago, I always think is like World War II. My clock sort of got stuck. And 40 years ago is, I mean, that's like 1969, right? That sounds like practically yesterday. And people had computers, they had programming language, they had electric lights, they had everything back then. And, you know, is there software? I mean, I can imagine software from 40 years still existing, still being available. I know it's around. Does it run? I think in some cases, yes, it does. I think is it reasonable to expect code from 1969 to still run? I'm not sure. I mean, maybe. It doesn't seem to me far-fetched, but given the advances in computing infrastructure, programming languages, all the different tools we have, thinking now about code running 40 years from now seems to me to be entirely reasonable and kind of inexcusable to sort of imagine that it's just going to deteriorate and fail in 40 years, since 40 years, at least in the context of my lifetime, just doesn't seem like that long anymore. In any case, I think that should be the aspiration, you know, that that your code possibly endures well beyond your interest is, and perhaps that should motivate as we start a project, as we make choices about how we do things, make some choices that are going to make that at least conceivable. And this is, one way to think of it is your software is kind of a time capsule that you should hope that somebody comes along 40, 50 years from now, opens up and is delighted by, you know, and sees something wonderful, like that feeling you get when you find the old advent, you know, the text adventure game Advent on a system somewhere, and you play it, and you remember playing it 30 years ago or whatever, 20 years ago. It's a neat feeling, and you should have that same aspiration for all your software, I think. Be a little time capsule. And it is, in some sense, a chance for immortality. Because I'm convinced, I mean, if you look at the degree to which material on the web is being archived and copied and stuff, that thinking in terms of that material still being out there somewhere, you know, in some, you know, probably some guy's laptop, you know, in 50 years will probably hold all of the web as it exists now. I mean, so it's easy enough to imagine all of our code still being around. And so it's our chance for immortality, which, not to be grim, but it's, I think about that a little bit. Our time is indeed finite. And it's nice to think about that work going forward and living on, if you will. I've been feeling a little morbid lately. And as well, maybe I've been away from home too long, but I mean also, you know, how many hours do we spend on this stuff and not doing other things that are arguably more fun? Maybe not more important, but they're a lot more fun. And that we devote to software. I mean, again, that's the nature of this discipline. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of time and effort spent creating, testing, and using software. And again, we should hope that it will last. And that we don't have to go through that over and over again, that, you know, maybe we start to build up a repository of tools, both individually and collectively, that will save us some time and allow us the Friday afternoon with family and friends or something like that. And I think if we're continually reinventing things, that's, you know, we spend our Fridays and Saturdays and Sundays doing that. And so, you know, again, 100 years from now, I mean, is this reasonable or not? I don't know. I suppose we won't know for sure. But I would at least like to believe there's some possibility that someone digging through the internet archives as they exist at that time will be able to unpack your code, read it, run it, and maybe appreciate it. You know, I mean, I'd be thrilled out of my mind to find, you know, some code from like 1953 that I could actually, I mean, it would be like a moving experience, I mean, I think, to be able to do that. And we should think of our future generations being able to do that. If that does not impress you, think about yourself 10 years from now. 10 years goes by fast, and you know, I think we find ourselves doing a lot of the same things, or going back to some familiar things, or remembering, oh yeah, I did this thing 10 years ago that's actually relevant to that. Does it work? It's great when it does. So if your software does all this, again, pretty well engineered. And I'm not, I mean, as you can tell, I'm sort of ducking the issue of, well, how do you do this? But I think, I don't think there's one single answer to that, but I think we all kind of have a sense or knowledge of our own habits and methods that both work towards that and work against it. And in the short term, I know it's always challenging sometimes to sort of be thinking about that long view. But in the end, I think it ends up saving quite a lot of time. And it also, perhaps more importantly, furthers the cause of science, because we have these resources that we can use and that others can build on too. And we save each other some time in the process. And I think that's very important. With that 100 years example, I've often tried to think about, well, what do I think about, you know, what's going to be running in that amount of time? And just as a generic example, you know, the Linux kernel, how long is that going to be up and running? And, you know, I don't know the value for X, but I think X is probably a pretty big number. You know, whatever X is, there's a good chance, for a few reasons. One, the company that does that won't be going out of business. You know, I'm certain, survive the loss of any of the key players now if they decide to do something else or as time goes by. And it's out there. I mean, you know, even if they stopped making new versions of the kernel today, how many copies of those exist in so many places around the world? I mean, is that still going to be there 50 years from now, 100 years from now? You got to think so. I mean, there's 20 some odd year old Usenet notes that I've sent, you know, much to my chagrin, that are still out there. I mean, so an entire, and those don't matter, an entire operating system matters. You know, start to get into a little discussion of programming languages and things like that. It's, you know, C is going to be with us, I think, for quite a long time, it continues to exist. So that might be a case of making choices that enable, you know, sort of an enduring thing. And then I think, always the concern, for example, with operating systems is just, the hardware architectures are going to change and we're not going to be able to run code anymore. And that's surely what's happened in the past. I mean, we didn't have, we had a wide range of different sorts of architectures and code that was, specifically written for those architectures, and that as those architectures went away, the code stopped working. And that's understandable, and that surely can still happen and may likely still happen, but I think there are ways to prevent that. And for example, all the virtualization technologies we see now, essentially offer a way perhaps to sort of keep architectures alive well beyond the actual lifetime of the hardware. And so I think if we're really believing, that we want this code to live for some period of time, even the reliable old excuse, shall we say, of, the hardware I was using went away, I think can be combated. And I think that's important. And so, again, this is kind of getting back to this issue of choices, making choices that give your code and your legacy a chance to endure. And this may be a little harsh, but, there is a risk if you go for the newest, most expensive, most remarkable sorts of technologies and hardwares. And again, this may be tremendously unfair, but there was a time when this was the thing to have. I mean, this is what computing was going to consist of. We're all going to be using Next Cubes and all kinds of cool stuff. And it didn't quite work out that way. And does that mean that we made a horrible mistake if we went that way? I mean, no, but at the time, there was probably a certain risk with adopting that maybe people decided to accept. Maybe that's okay, but if you don't actually absolutely need that, why not go a little more generic, save yourself a little money, and maybe allow a little bit more portability and a longer life for what you're up to. Here's another one, and again, this one I'm almost a little annoyed with myself for picking on this. Anyone recognize this? It's just boxes, right? What could it be? These are Symbolics Lisp machines, and these are, this is great stuff. But again, if your enterprise is relying on the existence of this hardware, you're in a little bit of a tough spot now. And again, that's not to say it's brilliant. I mean, the ideas contained here and in the previous system are brilliance. But again, there is a certain practicality that one has to consider about, okay, is this hardware going to be there, 20 years from now, 30 years from now, 40 years from now? And I think it's reasonable to be thinking about that because, as we'll see when we visit the history of science, real progress is happening over a much longer time frame than what we typically think about. So that's why I'm kind of raising these issues. So how do we make sure things endure long and for extended periods of time? I think we don't want to sort of hoard our wealth. I think, imagine that you have all of your software sort of tucked away maybe on this laptop here, and that's the only place that exists. And then you drop the laptop, or you forget about it, or somebody throws a magnet at it, whatever. I mean, one of the arguments for distributing software and making it available on sort of shared repositories is it backs you up. I mean, it's not like only sitting on your machine and your copies of it. You put it out there in a few different places, and then it gets mirrored and copies and stuff like that. And then there are so many copies of it that you have to do something. You can't lose it. And I think that's important to think about because as time goes by, you leave your job, your university, whatever. The university, I'm sure, will keep your web page up for 5 years maybe. 6 years, maybe less, depending on the circumstances that you leave. But relying on any sort of single institution or yourself to kind of keep all of your work available, I think is risky. And I think it's important to think about what if tomorrow you get a much better job than what you have now, you drop everything and you leave. All those people that were admiring what you did, following what you did, they should still be able to find out, and carry on what you were doing, even if you're not particularly interested. And so, again, I think 50 years from now, if I am if I am still alive and there is some slight probability of that, I imagine I can find some of the code that we've put out on CPAN and other places. I just imagine that'll be the case, because there's so many mirrors for that and so many other things that exist there that, you know, I mean, would I really want to do that? I'm not sure, but, you know, maybe somebody does. So we were talking about our definitions of good software running anywhere, anytime, for anyone. And we should think about what we mean by anyone. I think that's an important part of the equation. And do we mean anyone who happens to have $200? Is that our anyone? Is it someone with $20,000? Is it somebody with a PhD in computer science? That is, anyone can run my software, assuming that they have an advanced degree in this discipline. Is that the anyone you're shooting for? Do you also wish to require that they have $200? You know, which they may or may not. Do they need to have a staff? Do they need to have employees to be a part of the anyone that can run your code? And do they need to have lots of time available? And I think as you add more and more constraints to anyone, it's getting to be a really small group that's like made up of nobody, probably. And so, and then there's even more. Yeah, what if they need 6 months to actually re-implement what you did because of fatal flaws and things like that? I mean, anyone becomes nobody really fast as you start adding just a few of these constraints. And I think it's important to keep the anyone in mind. I mean, obviously you don't want to force, you know, 7-year-old children to run a parser probably or something like that. I mean, so, you know, we can agree perhaps to reasonable constraints on this. But, you know, anyone who might have a reason, you know, a legitimate reason, a student, you know, a person who's not, you know, particularly skilled as a program or something like that. I mean, I think we need to be generous in our interpretation of what it means for anyone to be able to use our code. And it's not anyone just like us. Or it's not anyone who has written a system like this, or it's not anyone who worked on this project. It's really anyone within a reasonable scope. And I think as we do that, things just kind of start to work a little better, and everybody can kind of profit from what we're doing. And so this is the interlude on goodness, where we'll actually talk a little bit about moral excellence, and I'll probably cross over into kind of a soapboxy sort of stance, which I'll retreat from very quickly. But it is important to understand, I think, and to remember that no matter how well we do our software, you know, the sad truth is that, you know, in terms of the lives of most of the people in the world, we may not be having too much of an impact. Life is hard and rather cruel for many people, and they are unfortunately outside of the realm of our ability to do much. And so should that make us sort of cower with guilt and give up everything and so forth? I mean, that's kind of a question for one's conscience. I would say not. But I do think it suggests the need for a little humility in the enterprise, that we are, in a sense, a very privileged class. And I think we should appreciate that, appreciate our good fortune, and maybe give just a little bit more thought and push ourselves just a little harder about what we can give back to the scientific community. That's maybe as much as we can do in terms of goodness and moral excellence, you know, beyond not doing, you know, obviously cruel or unethical experiments, you know, or lying and stealing money and things like that. But I mean, you know, since we are in such a good space, a good place, you know, maybe we can be a little gracious and a little humble. And think about the people who fund your work. And I'm not actually talking here about government project managers, legislators, or titans of industry and so forth. I'm this guy. You know, and it's a little corny, a little quaint maybe, but in reality, for a lot of us, that's the source of the funding. It's not some mucky muck at NSF or NIH or whatever. That's where it comes from. And you know, I don't know how much other people do this, but I sometimes get asked, what do I do and what do I work on? And I usually say I'm a scientist because I have aspirations, and they ask, oh, what kind of experiments do you do or whatever? And so I talk about trying to be able to automatically figure out the meanings of words in written text. And they look at me like I'm a little crazy, but more or less they like it. And they like that I'm doing that. And they say, this is really good. I hope it works. It's rather touching in a way, and I think there's a certain trust implied by that. And I think, again, how do you repay that? This guy probably doesn't need a word sense disambiguation program. I mean, he might. You know, he might need a machine translation program. If he has a friend in Belgium or something. But for a lot of what we do, there's not a direct connection, perhaps. But I think sort of taking that trust. I mean, I think there's a great trust of the scientific community in many respects, and sort of acting on that and in effect appreciating our good fortune, I think is important. And I think the best we can do is to make sure that we are sort of a hardworking, diligent part of that community, and maybe trying just to advance the overall course of science, because I think that's the expectation that you know, in general, people have. I'd encourage you to, you know, have those discussions. You may already, or if your, you know, children, friends ask you what you do, you know, they might say it's weird, but I've never actually had anyone say, you know, oh, why are you doing that? That's a terrible thing. That's a bad thing. You shouldn't do that. Nobody's ever said that, and I assume they would. So in the end, I mean, the goal here is, I think the reason there's that trust is that I think there is in general a belief in the public at large that science is about making progress and that we are all engaged in that enterprise. When our enterprise is so much entwined with software and stuff, making progress, I think, does depend a bit on how we handle that. So it kind of ties into that. So sort of the practice of good science. And so good science, again, we're talking about producing theories that make reliable predictions about the world, and that the experiments are going to be described in such a way that we can conveniently and reliably reproduce those results. That ties this back to good science in terms of quality. We had a little bit of a excursion with moral excellence, which you can sort of take or leave as you wish. But in terms of quality, I think you know, there can be some agreement on some of these points, at least I hope. So anytime, anywhere, by anyone is sort of our mantra. And if we talk about good theories in science, I would suggest gravity is a good theory. And why is it good? Well, it's working now. I mean, if I dropped this microphone, it would be working. And if we came back, you know, 10 years from now, it would still be working. It works here in Boulder, and it will also work on the moon. And that's actually a kind of a key point in the history of science, where there was this realization that the same forces that governed life here on Earth were governing the heavens, and it took an awfully long time to get there. And we'll talk a little bit about issues related to that. Gravity works for me, and it works for you. Now you might be quarreling a little bit with this and saying, well, gravity is a force. I mean, we're not really talking about forces here. We're software is more of an artifact. And so as I survey the history of science and think about artifacts, one interesting example is of course the telescope. That's an artifact. And I think most of us, you know, can use a telescope. The old ones still work. I mean, you can go up to a 200-year-old telescope and use it. I believe this is a replica of Isaac Newton's reflector telescope. There's no reason why the original one wouldn't work. And if you buy a reflector telescope for yourself now, it's going to be a lot like that, and it will work. I have a telescope that I got when I was 6 years old, and it still works. I can still use it. It works in Minnesota and everywhere else. So telescopes, what's happened with telescopes is that, of course, now we share the really big ones. So we have places like Kitt Peak National Observatory, where each university, each scientist, each laboratory is not expected to produce a place like this or to offer a place like this. It is a shared resource that I think has led to advances, significant advances, in astronomy. And so, you know, there's a metaphor here that I won't, you know, belabor too much more than I already have. If we have access to the same resources, one of the key points of that is we can actually reproduce each other's results. And that's such a key part of science, and that's a key part of why we have these big telescopes that are shared, the super collider places that are shared, all of these things. And if we're in a situation where we can't do that, it's extremely hard to reproduce each other's results. And so I think we, you know, one of our sort of action items is we want to think a bit more about that and work a bit harder to actually make that happen. If you're not convinced, I proposed to you an experiment. I've sort of probably already said the nature of the experiment. Randomly select one of your papers. One publication. And reproduce your results. And you don't need to report the results of your experiment. You can choose a paper as old or as young as you wish. And if you can do that, if you can't do that, do you think anyone else can? And I suggest to you the other people are not any better positioned to reproduce your experiments than you are. What would have happened if nobody could have reproduced Galileo's falling object experiment? Take two objects, different weights, drop them, they hit the Earth about the same time. What if nobody could reproduce that? I mean, would we have accepted that, believed that, just because Galileo wrote it and said it was so? I suggest we wouldn't have, and in fact, at the time, people barely believed him. There's a famous story. It's actually not a story, it's true. There was a rival professor in Pisa, I think, who conducted an experiment where he dropped he basically repeated the experiment following Galileo's instructions, which is a good sign for Galileo, and he dropped a big cannonball and a little marble or something, and there was a slight difference in when they hit the ground. And he said, "Eureka! You know, Aristotle is right. The falling bodies do fall at a rate proportional to their size." And so, you know, it does take time. You know, you have to sort of let consciousness and understanding of things sort of evolve with you. But if you don't even have the ability to replicate the experiments, those folks, that guy from Pisa at that time, surely would not have accepted it. So I think that's a crucial part. And so, you know, again, tying this back to our overall theme, if you can actually reproduce your results, it's probably pretty well engineered, whatever you did. And so our final interlude here, a few lessons from science. And the most important lesson, I think, from science, and that it's repeated over and over again, is that we don't get things right the first time. There are few episodes in the history of science where somebody just nails it the first time. Doesn't happen. And of course, we have the famous quote, "If I've seen further, it's only by standing on the shoulders of giants." This is, of course, due to Isaac Newton. He was, in effect, of course, saying that those previous giants were wrong. I mean, you know, he wouldn't have to be on their shoulders if they had gotten it right. I mean, so, you know, it was kind of a humble remark, but on the other hand, it's a little bit of a twisted knife there. I mean, I think he meant it graciously. This is an extraordinary one. This will be maybe the most controversial interlude here. This is a rather memorable statement that you may have seen. Reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me because, as we know, there are no unknowns. There are things we know we know. Okay. We also know there are no unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know. Now, when this statement appeared in the media, I happened to see it almost, I think, as it occurred somehow, and I thought, I totally understood this. I thought this made perfect sense. It became a bit of it's still mocked rather loud. Do you know who we're talking about here? Yeah, this is Donald Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense. The point here is that there is a certain amount that we just don't know. We can't see it. We don't even know what we don't know. And he's right. I mean, he's right. There he sits. He's thinking. And there's things he knows he doesn't know. And I think it's important to remember that. What is it we don't know and that we can't know we don't know? That's the problem. And so, say what you will about old Rummy, he more or less was subscribing to the "we don't get it right the first time" principle. So as we quickly go through the history of science, we can look back on, for example, Aristotle. I have always wanted to talk about Aristotle in a talk. And so Aristotle tells us there are four elements and that the heavens are different. The heavens are different rules apply up there. It's different stuff. And we look back on that now and it seems rather quaint and charming. But the reality is that, you know, before the telescope, the heavens really were different. You looked up there and it was fire. I mean, there was nothing like what we have here. We don't have balls of fire igniting on the Earth typically. And the heavens really were different. And without a telescope, how do you know that? I mean, you know, so give Aristotle a little bit of a break. Other planets were, you know, more like the sun than they were the Earth. And if you look at a picture of the stars, you go out and look at the stars tonight, unless you are kind of an experienced naked eye astronomer, picking out the planets is non-trivial. And it all kind of looks the same. And so Ptolemy was, among other things, an astronomer from long ago. And of course, he famously came up with sort of synthesized the theory of the Earth at the center of our universe. And there's Ptolemy, his artist rendering, I suppose. He has a little observing tool in his hand there. Make note of that. That's what he looked at the heavens with, a kind of a sextant-type device. And he actually made a lot of observations and collected a lot of data over a long career. He came up with the following theory: Earth at the center, orbited by the moon, all the other planets, and the sun orbiting the Earth, and these planets going in little epicycles as they work their way around the sun, the Earth. Now, is this just completely insane? I mean, is he a madman? In fact, not. This model actually very reliably predicts the movement of heavenly bodies. It explains the data pretty well. And if you view it in that light, it's a remarkable intellectual achievement. And indeed, stood the test of time for a long time because it was an accurate predictor. I mean, so at that level of science, it was good. This is sort of an instrumentalist view of science, where a theory that reliably explains and predicts your data is good. And Ptolemy's theory does that. By and large, it does that. What we add to that, why we diminish Ptolemy now, is that we like a certain, you know, we sort of insist on a certain level of reality or realism in our theories, and so we would like our theories also to describe things as they really are, you know. And what's interesting as you look at the history of science is that this wasn't always true. I mean, that it was sufficient to make good predictions of the heavenly bodies because we were interested in things like astrology and knowing the signs that were governing our lives, and not so much trying to understand, well, is it really true? Well, I don't know, but I can predict where the star, you know, where Mercury is going to be tomorrow, and that's going to help me. So Ptolemy was a great data collector, and he wrote a rather large book full of data and diagrams that found its way to Copernicus. Notice the, you know, the passing of 1,300 years or so. And there's Copernicus. And interestingly, he wasn't much of an observer. Ptolemy was much more of an observer and a data collector. Copernicus used 1,300 years later that sort of instrument to observe the heavens. Not all that different than what Ptolemy used. And that's certainly because Ptolemy left behind descriptions of how he made his observations. Copernicus found Ptolemy's model to be just a little too complicated. And he was wanting a simpler explanation, but he was wanting that because it would be more heavenly. Ptolemy's model struck him as not being divine. It was not the hand of God that would create these epicycles. It was imperfect. And so he sought a more perfect explanation, and he came up with another model that was essentially consistent with Ptolemy's data. And that's, of course, the model we're very familiar with, sun at the middle, planets orbiting. And that's great. I mean, that's a significant advance. However, it's not perfect. And so included in Copernicus's model was the fact that uniform, the speed of the planets around the sun should be the same. It should be uniform. And that they should be in perfect circles. Why? Because it's divine. I mean, it's that simple. And so in his book, he left behind his equations, his data, and That found its way eventually into the hands of Tycho, who was a truly great naked eye astronomer, perhaps the best. He built instruments of remarkable sophistication for naked eye astronomy, looking something like this. You can just look at that and see that's actually kind of a nice piece of engineering. And it's important to remember that Tycho came just before the telescope. It wasn't until Galileo that we had telescopes. And we had devices like that. And in 1610, Galileo observed the moons around Jupiter. He observed the planets. He saw they weren't so different, and that there were bodies that orbited other bodies and not the Earth, and started to put things together. But as we go back to Tycho, though, remember, he was before the telescope, and he made remarkably accurate observations over the course of 20 years. He knew all about Copernicus, and he arrived at his own theory based on detailed and accurate data collection informed by previous science. And that's what he came up with. Earth at the center, orbited by the moon and the sun. Sun, all the other planets orbiting the sun. And this model was known about at the same time as Copernicus, and there was great debate. And it wasn't really until the mid-1600s that the Copernican model was accepted. Now, so we would call that here at this conference perhaps a hybrid model. And it does fit and predict the observed data. So you have three competing models, in a sense, that are doing that. And Tycho, we remember, though, as a great scientist, because he engaged in one of the great acts of data sharing, and that is, on his deathbed, dramatically, as we tell the story dramatically, he essentially bequeathed his 20 years worth of data to Kepler. And they're standing here. Notice Tycho with his sextant, the great observer, and there's Kepler holding a scroll that's presumably that's Tycho's data, perhaps. I'm not sure. But with that data, Kepler went forth, and he was interested in astronomy before this. He came up with some kind of peculiar theories about why the heavens are arranged as they are, which I'll kind of breeze through here. But once he had Tycho's data, he was able to formulate Kepler's laws of planetary motion, which gave us varying velocities and elliptical orbits around the sun. And Newton came along to work out why the planets were actually moving and so forth. But the basic point here from the history of science here is that they were wrong more often than not. And these were really smart people coming up with models that fit their data and all the rest. But fundamentally, they were wrong. And so progress will occur in a science when people leave behind their data and their instruments so that those that follow us can build upon that. And if you look at the span of time from Ptolemy to Newton, or even to Kepler, it's a long time. And so I think we have to take a little longer view. So at the end, good science and good software probably should make assumptions that you don't get it right the first time, and that you might not even be the person to see what you did wrong, and you might not know what those unknown unknowns are. But if you leave behind a bit of a legacy, maybe somebody else can come along and fix it for you. So if you've achieved that, then that's some pretty good software engineering and also some pretty good science. So with that, I will conclude, and I thank you for listening to this rambling dissertation.
We have time for questions and comments.
I'll give you 10%. Maybe not 100 years, but 10.
Okay. I'll take it.
And, you know, what I observe in your comparisons is that the medium that we use to test our theories on is fairly ephemeral, and it's subject to either planned or unintentional obsolescence or market obsolescence. So, you know, had you owned one of those symbolics, would you have known that it was going to be obsolete in 5 years?
Yeah, and that may be an unknown unknown sort of example. Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah. So you know, the media that we're dealing with are ephemeral, but the media that you know, Copernicus and all the others used. I mean, it was hardware. It was not ephemeral, but you could rebuild it with a specification. Now, the issue that brings up is, are our specifications, i.e. our algorithms, our description of implementations, etc., are they complete enough to allow somebody who, you know, I mean, I remember 40 years ago in one of your other time frames, working in Fortran 4 on a CDC 6600, and I assure you that the meat, that the tapes that store my software no longer exist, much less the computer.
I very, very much agreed, and I think the point you're making about the specifications might be, I mean, I think whether or not our hardware and such our software continues to run as time goes by, there is a point at which it won't probably be happening. I mean, you know, one can't say for sure, but the issue of providing the specifications that would allow someone who is, you know, digging through the archives years from now, at least having those sufficient to have the ability to redo things, I think is at least a minimal, you know, kind of expectation that we should have. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I have 5 1/4 floppies in my desk drawer. I actually have an old 9-track tape from I left my first job. My first job was at Shell Oil in the early 1980s, and I was an assembly language programmer working on, you know, essentially they were Amdahl mainframes, and which were IBM clones. And I had my code carefully copied onto a 9-track tape, which I actually smuggled out of Shell Oil on my last day. I shouldn't have done that. But I thought, well, by God, I'm going to take this code with me. I still have the 9-track tape. I'm not entirely sure what I can do with it. So I didn't fully plan it out. Yeah, and that's a great example of, I think, in a sense where a scientist, a linguist, may well know that what they're collecting now, maybe that's not going to be immediately studied, but as languages start to die off, you want to at least open up the possibility that at some point later on somebody will, and doing that in a way that can make that happen across the generations, I think, is extremely important. It's sort of, you know, very much related, I think. I've lost track of who was. I don't know. Okay, yeah, thank you.
Well, I just want to make two remarks. The first relates to the analogy using early telescopes today. I think the reason for this is they were of tremendous simplicity. Mm. And that cannot really be compared to our current machines. Yeah. And you see, I mean, modern telescopes are not usable by everybody, anywhere, anytime.
That's true.
One thing. Second thing, when it comes to the use of software, we are part of a business. Telescopes are, more or less, because you can't put lenses, but this business aspect, and we shouldn't really get totally torn away from this part, because people try to hide their software either for a purpose of commercialization, money out of that, or in the scientific field, you want to have competitive advantage. I think right now we have to manage a piece of software that I really do not want to distribute right now, maybe in a year, for 1 year, or 1.5, for 1 year, I really want to have this, you know, exclusive right to use the
Yeah. No, it's not at all. And I would say I carefully avoided I don't think I said open source throughout the talk. And that was to kind of acknowledge that there are enterprises where you don't necessarily want to distribute it to everybody or outside your organization. But I would say within your organization, you would want whoever the possible users and programmers of that code to be able to kind of have code that lives up to that anytime, anywhere, anyone within our organization, if that's the case. I think that kind of standard can be useful, you know, internally as well, because you have the same issues of if an employee leaves, what happens to the next, you know, who's going to inherit it, how long will it take them to get up to speed. And so I think, I fully accept the idea that there will be code that will not and perhaps should not be distributed, but there is usually some kind of an internal organization that may have some of these same concerns and wants to achieve progress. I mean, you don't want to have junior programmers re-implementing, you know, the last junior programmers work for a year before they get going. So I think it's an extremely important point, and I guess I'm glad you mentioned it, because I obviously there is, you know, and using the example of Linux and so on, it does kind of, you know, point towards an open source thing. But I think some of these issues are equally true within organizations, and especially bigger organizations, I think, need to think about these just as carefully, maybe more so than individual scientists do, because, you know, I can survive a few mistakes with that. But I think, you know, if you're a company competing in the marketplace, I think being able to smoothly transition to new employees or whatever is important. And I think, you know, so I would view it in that way, I guess. And as far as telescopes, you're absolutely right. That's kind of forcing the metaphor a little bit, just to, you know, kind of something to think about. But yeah, telescope, I mean, we could probably get together today and build a telescope. And I mean, we might be able to build a computer too, but we'd have to buy a lot more parts and stuff. So yeah.
We're unfortunately out of time. You know, questions before the discussion session at the end of the day. Let's thank our speaker again, and David.